Hey, everybody. Welcome to August 3rd, 2020. I'm Larry. I'm Education Talk Radio. Actually, in a way, I am, but actually, I'm Larry Jacobs, and this is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio, and thanks so much for listening. Going to be a nice show. This wonderful lady I met when I was a guest at a webinar put on by my good friends over at the Turnitin company. Turnitin, you probably know all about them. You can check it out if you want. They're my friends, Turnitin.com. Good stuff, all about integrity and honesty, etc. Bronwyn Harris, okay, is an author, educator, and public speaker. She's written amazing books and Literally Unbelievable, which is stories from an East Oakland classroom and Letters from the Inside, Hope in the Journey Beyond Classroom to Sell, the School to Prison Pipeline, which is unfortunate. We're going to talk about that. I invited Bronwyn on to the show after we were together as panelists on the Turnitin webinar, and she happily agreed, so she's going to be my guest in just a few seconds. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org and tweet it out over at EduTalkRadio like we always do. Okay, you can tweet with us over there, and you can link in with us at Larry Jacobs. That's where I do that. And over on Facebook, it's Larry Jacobs and EduTalk Radio. Either one works. Please go over to ACE-ED.org. You know, one of the reasons I invited Bronwyn on is because I'm very interested in equity, accessibility to education for all kids. And, you know, we have our American Consortium for Equity in Education. As an educator or listener, you are welcome to join. It's free. It includes a subscription to our wonderful online journal, our official journal, which is called AC&E, Equity and Access. But we really want your voice heard. We're trying to create a place where the industry and educators and thought leaders can get together and work towards equity. And it's, again, free. We'd love to have you over at ace-ed.org, ace-ed.org. And so, without further ado, I hope I introduced her well. Let me introduce you to Bronwyn Harris. Good morning, Bronwyn. How are you today? It's Larry here.
Good morning. Good morning, Larry. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, believe me, it is my pleasure, and it's early in the day there at 9 a.m. out in California. I'm just thrilled you're here. I love doing that panel with you, and you really struck me as somebody who has not only has great thoughts but has experience. You're not only talking the talk, you walk the walk. You know, it's that simple.
Well, thank you.
Really,
I try.
You're doing it. And, you know, I never taught in a school, an under-resourced school like you did. And, you know, I do my best here for my little so-called ivory tower here in Maine. But you actually were in the classroom. You were in the prisons. And I really got to commend you on that because too few people really do that, and it's just wonderful, and I commend everybody who's doing that now. You know, and let's talk about your first, I think it was your first book, was the Literally Unbelievable, right? Stories from an East Oakland Classroom,
right?
Right? Okay, tell us about that book, okay? And if I can, and I love the word you use, I've always tried to look at the word, but it's under-resourced. That's the word. Okay, and just talk about what it was like in the school. Tell us what school you worked in, etc. Please.
Sure. So I worked at a school in East Oakland that is actually no longer there. It's been the physical building is there, but it's been it was designated under No Child Left Behind as a failing school, so it got closed and turned into a few different other schools. And it was in what the police, I didn't know this when I had my interview, but the police called that neighborhood the killing zone because it was the, I know, right? I was 24 when I started there. I took over for a
this
teacher.
This is 3 years, that's 3 years ago, right? 3 years ago, am I correct? 24?
Yeah,
3 years
I wish.
Ago? Thanks. Okay.
Yeah, so I took over for a teacher who had started having panic attacks every time he saw the school, which, again, no one told me that either. And it was just also, you know, the reason the title is Literally Unbelievable is because I had a friend who would tell me, I would tell stories about this school and she'd say, you know, we can't believe you. It's not that you're a liar. It's that what you're telling us is literally unbelievable. So,
you know, I think,
started,
and now, by the way, I think the other way I read that title, which you've probably heard, okay, is the word literacy in there. Okay, when I read literally unbelievable, not only is it unbelievable that such that kids have to go and teachers have to teach in such under-resourced schools, okay? But that it's unbelievable to somebody's ears. It's just amazing. Go ahead, continue. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Right. So everything was, you know, I had grown up middle-class white person, and things did feel very unbelievable. If I hadn't been there, I don't know if I would have believed it. So I started writing it down, and eventually I turned it into a book.
And can you give us one story from the book that just tells us how unbelievable it is?
Oh, sure.
Or 10. It's up to you.
So, this actually isn't in the book, but I had a teacher colleague who tried to trade his black kids to me. So he said to me, my first year of teaching, and some things I left out of the book because they were too unbelievable.
Yeah.
My first year of teaching, he said to me, okay, so I'll give you my black kids and I'll take your Asian kids. And I said, what are you talking about? You know, I was 24. And he said, well, I don't have to teach the black kids. We've just established this. And he was, you know, that racist that he didn't want, and he didn't consider it racist. He said, well, they're just harder to teach. And, you know, he had all these prejudices that he didn't consider racist at all. And so every year he would trade with African-American students. And I took them because my first thought was, I don't want them in his class. You know, this is terrible. I don't want any kids in his class, let alone the kids he's looking to not have in his class.
Oh, my God.
But you know, I told the principal, and she said, oh, that's just how he is. And the
of course,
you know,
he's got tenure. He's probably still there.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was one of the ones where I'd tell people, and they'd say, oh, you're exaggerating. And, you know, I wasn't exaggerating.
Yeah. You know, there's two things that come to mind, okay? And first of all, just the phrase, I'll trade my black kids, okay, is such a racist term. I mean, I'm thinking of like I'm probably carrying it too far in my head, but I don't know if I'm the only one who thought like this, like it's a slave owner. I'll trade you two of mine for three of yours. I mean, it's absurd.
It feels like ownership. Yeah, exactly.
It's disgusting and absurd. And wow. And jeez, I just can't. I can't believe
enough.
It. And
yeah,
the principal knew where they.
That people,
yes, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, people were just accepting of it now because he had done it long enough.
Yeah, and you know, he'd done it long enough. Like I said, he's probably still there. This is one of the challenges. Okay, and it's so sad. You know, you said something that struck me really, really that they didn't tell you these things in the interview. And you are a nice person and a good person. You're a caring person. And I don't think you're a racist type person. I don't know you that well, but I could be pretty well assured of that. But if they had told you those things, okay, this is the killing zone. Did you know that? The last teacher had panic attacks and kept crapping his drawers every time he stood outside in the parking lot. Would you have taken the job? What do you think?
I probably would have. I'm pretty stubborn. Yeah. I probably would have. A lot of people wouldn't. But, I probably would have, but I would have been a little more aware of what was going to happen.
That's a great answer.
Yeah,
so it was an awareness problem, okay, an awareness challenge. Okay, that's a wonderful answer. I really like that. And, you know, what the neighborhood, by the way, was this a junior high, high school, what was it?
I taught third grade. It was was an elementary school.
No.
Yeah.
You're not serious.
It was next door to a junior high. No, I'm totally serious. It was next door to a junior high. So it took up the block of, if anyone knows East Oakland, it was, I don't know where your listenership is from, but it was
all over.
The block right north of the College of Oakland Coliseum. And it was across the street from a funeral parlor. And
we had
the junior high on one side. You can't make this stuff up. A junior high on one side and the elementary school on the other side.
Yeah, I have to ask you something, and this I can't. You said that the teacher before you was having panic attacks, and I conjured up in my head a high school full of really dangerous kids, or at
right.
least seemingly dangerous kids, all right? That's what I conjured up in my imagination here. Then you just hit me with the fact that third grade. Was there fear amongst the teachers? We're talking third grade or sixth grade or fifth grade. What are we talking about here?
There was. For me, the kids were never the problem. I love the kids. And one of my biggest problems is when teachers treat kids as adversaries. You know, we're all on the same
team. Of course.
I love the kids. But we had a student, he's in my book. I call him Fred in the book. I had him in first grade. He had just the most horrific family life you can ever think of. And then in second grade, he hit a teacher and he was expelled. And of course, we all know expelling a second grader isn't going to help anything. It just sends them down the road to the other school. You know, nothing's going to get better. And then it turns out he was expelled from the other school, so he sent back to us. And so I had him again in third grade. And he loved me. And I had a contentious relationship with his mother because I had to call Child Protective Services a couple times. Not on her, on her husband. But, you know, and she knew it was me, even though it's supposed to be anonymous. But all the way through the end of elementary school, he would come to me when he had problems. You know, the kids pick up if someone respects them, if someone's there for them, that you're not going to have any problems.
Yeah.
But if they see you as an adversary, then you are. Now, I still think, you know, they're still elementary school kids. I still would not have been scared of them, but they had big brothers and they had parents and, you know.
Really?
The parents would get threatening. Yeah.
That's terrible.
And the other teachers, some of them were really, really great, but so many of them, it just burned them out. So a lot of times the problem, not violence, but the problem in a lot of other ways was the other adults.
Oh, well, it's just, there's so many things. When you look at the school, and you use the term under-resourced, okay? And I don't know if you taught in other Oakland schools, and, you know, Oakland's a pretty good-sized city. It has its challenges, that's for darn sure, like everybody, like every other big city, okay? But I don't know if you taught in other schools or knew people who taught in other schools, but when you say the word under-resourced, okay, describe what that word really meant.
Another way I often say it is ignored, or, you know, kids who are forgotten about, because theoretically we had more money than other schools. We were a Title I school. We were supposed to get more money. You know, I don't know where that money went. Sometimes it went to, you know, these sort of elaborate programs that would happen for 6 months or a year and then we'd never see it again. But, you know, I spent every year, I spent between $4,000 and $6,000 of my own money because we didn't have enough paper. We didn't have enough pencils, and we were supposed to. You know, I don't know if it was just mismanagement of funds, what it was.
Wow.
So I had friends from schools who would collect supplies from their schools, and they would give it to me. Because Oakland is really very, very diverse. There are very wealthy schools in Oakland where the PTA give them budgets to buy supplies and field trips and computers. And I literally had a friend who was at Hewlett-Packard at that time who would build me computers out of the scraps that were left over at work.
Wow.
Because we didn't have, this was in the year 2000. I had some Apple IIe's in my classroom, which were, you know, from the early 1980s. So we just didn't have the physical things we needed, but also, and I talk about this in my book, the resources, but also the kids didn't have tutoring. They didn't have after school programs. They didn't have, you know, ice skating lessons. They didn't have any of those things. And a lot of times, it's not that their parents loved them any less. You know, their parents cared about them just as much as upper-class parents, obviously. But their parents didn't have the resources.
Yeah, which brings me to my next – actually, that's a great segue. And I was going to ask you this next. That's a great segue. Who was advocating for the kids, if anyone?
That is – an excellent question. So we didn't have a PTA because we had too many languages at the school. And we had parents who were parents who were working two or three jobs. So we didn't have a PTA, and the parents wanted to advocate, but they either didn't know how, they didn't have the education, or maybe they were not in the country legally and they were afraid to. So it all fell on the teacher. So I was advocating, it was really lonely. You know, I was advocating, and some of the teachers, like I said, were really burnt out. Those of us who weren't advocating for the kids, but every year we'd lose a bunch of those teachers because it was such a hard place to work.
Oh, jeez. But I guess my question is, and I know the answer, but I just want to hear it kind of from you. Why did it become, or how was it, such a hard place to work? I mean, we're talking about an elementary school. We're talking about, I don't care what anybody says, parents do want their kids to do better than they do. Okay? When did it start? Have you any idea where the disconnect happened? Why wasn't the school board? It's very frustrating to me. You can hear it in my voice. Okay? Why wasn't somebody on top of this? What kind of principal? Tell me. Help me, Brownwood. Help me.
Right. Yeah. So we had, I was there for 8 years. We had 8 principals. We just went through principals.
Oh, my God.
So fast. We also had 5 superintendents at that time. So there was no accountability.
8 years.
Eight years, 8 principals. One of them was excellent. And that was the year that the school got shut down, and thanks to George W. Bush. But we had, you know, and none of the principals said they were only going to be there for a year. You know, one of them, her health started being effective. One of them just gave up halfway through. I mean, I can remember the day she gave up and she just closed her office door and wouldn't come out and wouldn't talk to us. So there just was no leadership. And then, you know, the superintendent, at one point we were under I forget what it was called, state receivership or whatever.
Yeah, receivership, because, whatever that is. Yeah, management. Yeah.
Right, because of the budget. And there was just no leadership. There was no leadership there. There was no leadership in the, you know, district office. And the other schools, so Oakland's very divided between what we call the hills and the flatlands, and the hills are the rich areas. And in there, they can keep their teachers and they can retain their principals. And so there is leadership if there's not coming from the district. And for us, it was such a hard place to work that the principals just never stayed.
It's beyond belief. And let me ask you something, and I know you've put thought into this because we're going to go into your next book, which was called Letters from the Inside, about the school to prison pipeline. Talk about your do you remember the name? What was the name of the elementary school?
Which one? The one I taught at?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was called Lockwood, and it's not there anymore.
Right, right. So Lockwood Elementary had its problems, okay? It had some good teachers, some bad ones. And, of course, then you sent the kids on to middle school, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the impact of having such a bad elementary experience. Again, I don't mean to blame the teachers or anything like that, but a bad elementary experience for the kids, then moving them on to junior high, then to high school. It's a segue right into that school-to-prison pipeline, if I may. I mean, there must have been a tremendous impact. It's just beyond belief. I mean, I know you were teaching third grade the whole time. You were sending kids to fourth grade. Okay, but man, social, emotionally, were they ready? Education-wise, were they ready? It's that kind of thing. What's the impact, in your opinion, Brumman, of poor elementary and maybe preschool, okay, on this school-to-prison pipeline?
Oh, it's really profound. And the thing I didn't know until, and again, we had very good teachers, but it was very piecemeal.
Yeah.
Like, you know, all of us would try to do what we could in our classroom, but there was no consistency whatsoever. And we didn't have counselors. We didn't have any kind of, you know, we didn't have any kind of socio-emotional help unless we made it up ourselves, which I tried. But, you know, I wasn't trained in that. So what I didn't know was that a lot of kids dropped out after fifth grade, before middle school.
After what?
And
after what grade?
I didn't know that until I asked somebody, I said, oh, you know, is so-and-so in your class? And they said, no, he dropped out. And I looked at him, I said, you're in sixth grade. He said, yeah, he dropped out. He hangs out in front of the school smoking weed all day. And I guess I shouldn't say a lot, but there are kids who dropped out between fifth and sixth grade and they weren't caught.
God.
So, but then when they got into middle school, so this young man that I wrote the book with, the second book, Jorge, he went to a middle school where, you know, he was treated very badly, and kids learn. And again, those teachers probably started out good and they probably became jaded. Most of them, you don't go into teaching for the money. So I've got to think they had good intentions going in.
I hope.
But,
yeah.
One hopes. Yes.
Yeah.
And
one hopes.
Kids learn really fast that it's better to play the class clown than admit you can't read, because it's embarrassing to admit you can't read. So they get kicked out of class, and then it just gets worse and worse and worse. And they're not going to succeed, and they get disenfranchised really young, especially when they learn that that teachers are adversaries and teachers don't want them there. So
that's
what happened to him. He dropped out. I don't think he dropped out till high school, but he basically stopped learning in about fifth grade.
It just turned off. It was what he did. Just flipped the switch. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I hate to use that. It's literally unbelievable, okay? And unfortunately, it's too true all over the place. Literally Unbelievable is the name of Broadman's book,
right. Okay?
And I'm telling the audience, I know you know that, okay? And, what would you have done? How long ago was this, if I may ask?
This was 2000 to 2007, so eight years.
Okay, not that long ago, all right? And so knowing what you – and I know you're a speaker and all that sort of thing. And when you look at this from hindsight, what would you have done differently, if anything, okay, regarding your fellow teachers, regarding working with administration, regarding dealing with the families, which is a big question. But just looking back, what would you have done differently?
I would have spoken up a lot more. I was afraid for my job until I was tenured. And then by then I just thought it wasn't worth it. And I was still, I stopped teaching when I was 31 or 32. So I hadn't really come into a lot of confidence, but I would have spoken up a lot more. I would have said things like, no, you absolutely, there's a problem when a teacher wants to trade their kids of a certain ethnicity. And we need to talk about this problem. And I wouldn't let anyone brush me off on it. I would have talked about, the fact that we were segregating kids by language, and they had all their reasons for doing that. But what that meant was that kids who spoke different languages or kids who were different races didn't interact with each other. I would have probably made enough noise about needing a counselor until we got one, or I would have written grants or something like that. I didn't know that I could agitate, I think.
Yeah, I understand it. And you were younger then. No, we're all younger. We go through all these experiences, etc. I mean, it's if you were the principal, okay, look back that way. What would you have done? Well, first thing, you would have fired the slave trader there.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
If I were the principal, I would have gotten parent involvement, and they wrote it off
wonderful.
As, "Oh, it's too hard this language.
No, it isn't.
It's too hard. I don't speak whatever." The district had translators. You had to go through some paperwork, but the district had translators, and we mostly just had, at that point, mostly if we'd gotten Spanish and Vietnamese translators, we would have been set. The demographics have changed since then, but it would not have been too hard. And there was a lot of mistrust between the Spanish-speaking and the English-speaking community, that was in part because they never were together. They never sat down and did anything together because of the language barrier. And so the principal really needed to be responsible for that, for bringing the community together.
That is a wonderful answer. And boy, talk about hindsight. That is actually exactly the answer that probably would have made all the difference in the world. Right then and there.
I think so.
There
was a lot of distrust between the Mexican-American and the African-American community. And in large part, it's because they never talk to each other.
Isn't that amazing? It's just amazing. But they were together, right? I mean, they were together in their classes. They just couldn't break those barriers.
They were not necessarily together in classes, because we had some classes in Spanish instruction and some in English instruction.
Mm.
But that was another problem that I brought up to the principal. And I said, I'm really concerned about them being divided by race. And she said, they're not divided by race, they're divided by language. And I just looked at her and I thought, how many black kids do you know who speak Vietnamese? They're divided by race.
Yeah.
So But again, you know, I was too afraid to say anything.
Well, and as most people would be, which brings up the next question. The school district was afraid to tell you the truth. Okay, you said it at the beginning during your interview. All right, and let me ask you again, hindsight's always 20/20. But looking back, what should the school district have done before they hired you, besides giving the former teacher some heavy-duty drugs to control his panic attacks? Xanax, I think it is.
Right.
Okay,
right.
A lot of Xanax. Exactly. Take this one. It's 6 inches long. But that's besides the point, okay? Yeah. What should the school district have done to prepare you? Because
didn't. When I was teaching, there was absolutely no kind of mentoring program. There was later. But my first staff meeting, the principal said, okay, we have a new teacher who wants to mentor Ms. Harris. And we sat in total silence for about 5 full minutes. And she said to me, okay, you don't get a mentor. And we kept going. So there was nothing formal at all. And all the teachers, and I understood after being there for a year or two, that all the teachers just closed their doors and tried to do the best with their own students because everything else was too overwhelming. So the school district needed to do some kind of teacher support, which they just didn't, and that led to huge teacher turnover. And I think also, I think they need to have a pay scale based on where, you know, some people call it hazard pay or whatever, because I was paying a lot more in school supplies, and honestly, I was paying a lot more
good
in therapy
point.
Because it was a hard place
good
to
point.
Work.
Good point.
And some districts do that, not many, but, and they needed to be upfront because, like I said, I would have done it anyway. I would have gotten more prepared, but there are other people who definitely did not want to be in that kind of area, and they should have been told and not had a bait and switch.
Well, if you don't want to be in that area, okay, then you're really not going to be a very good teacher in that area.
That's exactly right.
It's that simple. And that's what the school district needs to understand. Maybe they do 8 years later, but they certainly didn't back then. They just needed warm bodies, to be perfectly honest, in front of the classroom.
That's exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And by the way, instead of calling it hazard pay, I call it resource pay.
There you go. Oh, I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's better than hazard pay, but you do need more resources, and teachers spend too much out of themselves. So let me jump a little bit ahead. Your friend Jorge, okay, who you wrote the book Letters from the Inside, tell us about him.
Oh, he is just a fantastic young man who had the self-awareness that is rare to find in kids. And he has, you know, a very tragic story. Mom did not come in the country legally. They should have gotten asylum. They didn't know how. They were running from the war in El Salvador when his grandma was a teacher and she had a baby. And so his mom from a very early age had a drug and alcohol problem. And I think she had him when she was 14. So, and his grandma is a wonderful person who I'm still in touch with. She doesn't speak English, and she doesn't read or write at all. She never had a chance for schooling. So he was very much the adult in the family from kindergarten on, and which is tragic. And he also had, like I say, this self-awareness. You know, he would ask me things like, how can I learn to be good when other people have parents who can teach them how to be good, and I don't have that, so how can I learn? You know, and he was just trying his best. He tried so hard. And he was just this wonderful kid. And, you know, there's a lot about him actually in both of my books. But, you know, skipping forward, he was, you know, I have example after example about why I thought he was really special. But skipping forward, he saw his best friend. He saw his best friend murdered when he was 13. They were both 13. It just sent him over the edge, as it would for anyone. And then the Oakland police treated him as a suspect, and they wouldn't allow him to have an adult in the room, and you know, they just did everything very illegally, and so he developed this huge distrust of the police and was completely traumatized, and so he joined a gang to protect his family, and it all went downhill from there.
And then
I got back in touch with him, and he's really trying to turn his life. He's in prison. I'm not going to say which prison because we're trying to keep him anonymous. He's really trying to turn his life around, and so we wrote the second book together.
Is he going to get out of prison soon?
He has, I think, 9 more years.
Well, I hope he gets out. Sounds like a decent person. And I hope he gets out. He's going to get. He's a wonderful guy, is what you're going to say, and I'm sure he is. And he's got to take care of himself. What would he like to do as he looks back on his life? What would he? It sounds like a smart guy too. What would he like to do when he gets out?
He wrote about this at the end of the book. He would like to start a family. He just really wants to.
Yeah.
He has a fiance who is somebody who he's known his whole life. Most of his life, he wants to have a family. He wants to be a dad. I think he wants to. He's studying. He's learning to be an electrician in prison, and he wants to work. Yeah, he really wants to work to earn money and to, you know, just very simple things that we take for granted, and to be a dad. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well. I wish him luck. I have to tell you. Okay. What are you doing these days, Bronwyn? Would you describe your life now? What are you doing?
So busy. My life is busy. I do private tutoring. I would love to be back in the classroom, but I can't afford it in California. I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I think where we've hit the most expensive area in the country now. And
you are.
I can't afford to go back. Yeah. So I do private tutoring, and then I do a lot of volunteer work with a group called Children Rising, which helps kids in Oakland like the ones I taught. Yeah.
Nice. I always tell my friends who live in San Francisco, especially if they own a house, there's one fellow I work with who originally is from Maine, and now he lives out in Silicon Valley. And I said what he should do is sell his house there and come back and literally buy the state of Maine. Okay?
Right.
But just the pro.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you ever want to teach, we need teachers out here. We need good teachers out here. Okay? It's a lot more affordable out here. You know, here in Maine, it's a pretty nice place to live, except we do have winter, I have to tell you. We do have winter. Okay.
I'm a long time California. I'm allergic to winter.
Yeah, and you would be. I always say this is a – well, of course, with the pandemic, it's not good. But, you know, it's a wonderful place to live and a wonderful place to visit, but not February, March. Okay, not January. Yeah, those are the bad times. Okay, they're really tough. You would hate it. You're really something, I got to tell you, and the stories you put together are really, they're really, really important because too few people have an understanding of what's going on out there. And it's easy to close your eyes and move on and all that sort of thing. But, you know, the fact that you're putting pen to paper and getting this stuff done, I think it's wonderful, and I think you've accomplished a lot, and hopefully you're going to keep getting the word out. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I hope so. Thank you for having me.
Believe me, my pleasure. It's wonderful to know you. Let's stay in touch, okay? And I will see you again soon, I hope. Okay? Thanks, Bronwyn.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks.
And stay safe,
Thanks.
Please.
Bye.
Yeah, stay safe out there, please.
Yes, I will.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bronwyn Harris, everybody. Her book, okay, is called Literally Unbelievable. Obviously, you can get it on Amazon. Literally Unbelievable, Stories from an East Oakland Classroom. And then the second book is Letters from the Inside, Hope in the Journey Beyond Classroom to Cell. So beyond that, and I hope that kid does really, really well, Mr. Jorge. All right, well, just amazing. There you have it. All right, we're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org. Where we put our schedule up every Saturday, and we'll tweet it out at EduTalk Radio. Please join our equity consortium. We want to hear your voice. Bronwyn, you too, over at ACE-ED.org. I'm Larry Jacobs. Thanks for listening.